very excited today to have Dr. Giorgio Gelestro here with us on the podcast. He's senior lecturer and lab head in the Department of Life Sciences at Imperial College London. And Dr. Gelestro has been studying a very fundamental question that I think we're all very familiar with, and yet I think it's fair to say it's been quite a difficult question to maybe answer, and that is, what is the function of sleep? And so his lab has expertise in studying this question in a very fundamental way using a reductionist model, the Drosophila fruit fly.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
Yeah. Before we really get into the main question of your lab, why do we sleep? I first want to just start with a more basic question, which is, what actually is sleep?
Right. So those two questions actually are very related. And I will say that we cannot answer any of them. So we don't know why we sleep, and also we don't know what is sleep. And I guess if you could answer one, then you could answer the other. We do know that sleep is ubiquitous in evolution. Pretty much all animals that have been studied show to a certain extent that they require sleep, some more, some less. We have puzzles that needs to be solved. For instance, bats can sleep 20, 21 hours a day. Elephants will sleep 2 hours a day, or like cows. So explaining what sleep does also means explaining how this can be achieved in 2 hours in one animal, while another requires 21. So it adds to the complexity of the system, and in part explains why we still don't know what sleep is and what it does. We don't know, for instance, how ubiquitous it is. Do plants sleep? Do yeasts, you know, single cell organisms sleep? We don't have an answer to that, because we don't have a good biological marker of sleep. Mm-hmm. Since we don't know what it does, at the same time, we don't know how to look for it. The only way we can look for it is through correlates. Now, in humans, you mostly use what are called electrophysiological correlates. So the classical EEG and what we study in school about non-REM sleep, REM sleep. But those are correlates again. And in flies or other animals, you can use behavioral correlates, which are the correlates that you can experience when you see someone sleeping. You know that. You recognize when someone is sleeping, unless they're faking it, because they lay down, they close their eyes. And so we look at something like this in many animals. But because those are just correlates and they are not necessarily universal, I think it's fair to say that nobody's really studying sleep. We're all studying sleep correlates. Mm.
That's really interesting. So when you then think about actually studying this in a lab, you must sort of at least define these markers of the sleep correlates, right?
Yeah.
So in order to practically do your experiments. And I know you've actually done a lot of technical innovation in this area to help, you know, us identify what we would consider sleep in, for example, Drosophila.
Right. Yeah, so sleep is one of those fields actually that maybe took a different path from a lot of different biomedicine or biology, where we almost started from humans and then, well, all the way to animals. First studies were done in humans, and even just when EEG was born, which somehow we can, you know, count as the day one of neuroscience to a certain extent, people look at the difference in EEG pattern between an awake person and a sleeping person. But it relied on on humans and on asking them whether they were asleep or awake. Now, in animals, we can do that to a certain extent. We can probe their arousal threshold, so we can give them stimuli and see whether they react to those stimuli. If they don't, then I think it's a good assumption to think that they're asleep, most of the time at least. I mean, there are other conditions where the animals do not respond to stimuli, but in the normal day, in the normal 24 hours, the arousal threshold is probably the best way to poke and check whether an animal is asleep or not. It has a problem, though, again, and that is a bit of a interfering problem, like a Heisenberg problem, where it's like asking you, are you asleep, and wakes you up.
That's
so
right.
It's a bit like, if you want to know whether someone is asleep by this means, you'll wake them up and interfere with the sleep. So it's not ideal. So the other way of doing this is really just by observation of their behavioral correlates, which is what we do in flies. We use this Raspberry Pi's computer, so these microcomputers, which cost $30 or something like that. And we attach them to a camera, and then we create machines that look down at the flies, and doing machine learning can tell us whether the flies are moving, non-moving, interacting, doing micro-movements, and then we can also infer sleep from this data.
That's great. So one thing, maybe, Kevin, we can actually show a picture of one of these devices that you built, because I love that you've made the extra effort to make them accessible and open source. You even had one made out of cardboard. You had the more fancy one made out of 3D printed, even Legos. My son would love that.
Yes.
He'll be building one this weekend, maybe.
yes. No, I mean, that's the only way to do science, is to share what you do. I mean, we are used to sharing results. Now it's become common practice, hopefully, sharing data, sharing results. But I think if you really want other people to reproduce your experiment, you have to put them in the condition to also to share the equipment that you created. And now, I would say, in the past 10 years, with all the makers revolution, this has become easier and easier, because accessibility of 3D printer is now almost ubiquitous. More and more biology graduates understand a little bit about electronics and programming and robotics. And it's fun. It's also fun. Let's remind you this. You sit down there and you create something, and it's a good way to create new hypotheses as well, because once you have a new tool, only then can you think about new experiments.
Yeah, so now that you can, you know, measure sleep in flies, you can begin to, you know, measure the differences in sleep across species and also within species. And I think when you begin to address your question, such as why do we sleep, you start, you know, naturally turning to questions of evolution.
Yes.
And conservation. So I'm curious, how conserved is sleep sort of within and across species?
Right. So absolutely, for me, anything, I mean, not just for me, in general, in biology is understood that anything is there for a purpose, and that purpose is species specific, or at least, evolutionary relevant. And I think sleep is not any different from this. So if we are to understand sleep, we have to understand how it evolved, what is the pressure that created sleep in the first place, and now how this goes then when manipulated from species to species in the evolutionary tree. We started doing this looking at different Drosophila, so non-melanogaster. The Drosophila melanogaster is the one we are normally used to, what we call fruit fly, and you know, it's been, without any doubt, one of the most important animal model in biological research for the past 150 years. But now, with the revolution in genomics and CRISPR modification, all these kind of things, we can do all kind of comparative experiments with other Drosophila, which are not melanogaster. They might be millions of years away in terms of evolution, but somehow have lots of similarities. And so we can use the similarities and those differences to study then how a little change in behavior, all things being equal, can be explained, say, by a different neuronal circuit or by a different gene expression. So that's the strength. You take species which are close enough that most things are similar, and then you see what are the genetic differences that underlie those few things that are actually different. And Drosophila are good also for this from the behavioral point of view, because clearly living at different conditions in environment, they are subjected to different evolutionary pressure. If they are different latitudes, for instance, or if they eat different type of food, this will have an effect on their survival and their adaptation. So you can imagine that normally flies, for instance, sleep, at least male flies, sleep through the afternoon because it's too hot to hang around. If they live in an environment where afternoons are less hot, then they might sacrifice that sleep actually to do something a bit more interesting or productive for them. But on the other hand, if they live somewhere like in a desert where the afternoon is even hotter, then you might see that even females in those conditions actually might sleep more, or something like that. You know, so there is a adaptation, ecological adaptation, that then has to match changes in the genes. And we can start to study that, not just in a descriptive way, but now also by changing genes with CRISPR and doing modification of what used to be possible only melanogaster, also in other species.
So if you can manipulate genes in these flies and affect their sleep patterns, have you been able to, or others in the field been able to, make flies that don't sleep, for example?
With Melanogaster, yes. We have, us and others have identified flies that don't sleep or sleep very little. They can be either mutants. In the field, we have some. For instance, there is a mutant in the dopamine transporter genes that really shows hardly any sleep, and yet they live a normal life, and they have appropriate longevity, as they would expect in a normal fly. We also found in the wild flies that actually have hardly any sleep. So it's a natural trait of population, and in biology everything has a normal distribution. And so at the end tail of the normal distribution you find all kind of extremes. Also when it comes to this, you find flies that sleep a lot and flies that sleep very little. I guess that's, again, that's how evolution builds enough variability so that you have within a species, you have enough individuals with different properties that are able to withstand any possible novelty in terms of pressure and, you know, challenge. So that if something happens, you are equipped with actually enough variability to engage it.
Mm. That's really interesting. So if there's this really wide variability in the amount that these individual flies, for example, sleep, is there an evolutionary drive to sort of an ideal amount of sleep in these species?
I think, yes, there's probably not. Because it's a normal distribution, you can start talking about a normal amount, and that will be what most flies experience. We see that in other species as well. So obviously there are animals that in certain conditions tend to sleep a similar amount of time. In other conditions, that amount suddenly changes. So a good example of this is the cavefish. Cavefish are fish that were trapped millions of years ago in caves in Mexico mostly. They developed different sleep behavior and sleep traits. Now those animals, without predators, but with limited food, they sleep on average 1 hour a day or less. Their ancestors that remain on the surface, and they're still the same species because you can cross them and have non-sterile hybrids. Their ancestors, they sleep still 7 or 8 hours a day in different conditions. So that's clearly an example of how evolution and different environment shapes the genes to adapt, to better adapt to that environment.
Interesting. So I'm wondering, we talked about, you mentioned these mutant flies that don't sleep still live relatively normal lifespans.
Yes.
So I'm guessing that means that sleep is not actually required.
I think it's difficult to come to terms with what we even mean by required. So if I were to be sleep deprived now and then drive a car, I'd probably kill myself. So in that sense, sleep is a vital necessity for me. On the other hand, if I go without food for days, I also die, but it's a different biological process that leads to my death. In one case, the food... I will say that this is vital for myself, for my organism. I think we don't know whether that's the same for sleep. I will argue actually that's not the same, because the evidence we have from humans is basically non-existing, because you cannot really do those experiments. You cannot just sleep deprive someone until they die, thankfully. And with animals, we have very, very poor experimental evidence anyway, because those experiments were done at a time where techniques were still primitive. Now we cannot even do them anymore because they're considered too cruel. So in general, the experimental evidence that sleep is a vital necessity is lacking. In other animals like flies, obviously we can do more experiments because there is less an ethical concern. And there we see we can sleep deprive them basically all their life without a clear impact on their longevity. Then again, I suppose if you sleep deprive a fly and you put them together with a fly that has not been sleep deprived and see who can escape better from a spider, as probably will be the one of the non-sleep deprived one that will survive. We have not done this experiment, but I think it's a fair hypothesis. So that is why it's difficult to come to terms with what it means to be, vital. Clearly, a lot of sleep can be explained just by keeping us out of trouble, hypothesis. So obviously, if you're a fly again, you don't want to fly at night where you don't see where you're going. And the same applies to most species, which are really reliant on their vision. Or if you are an animal who lives at a very warm climate, you don't want to go around in the middle of the afternoon where it's very hot. And that's why a lot of culture that live in snow climate have the siesta culture. So a lot of sleep can be explained by just this natural drive to avoid wandering around when it's dangerous, and actually concentrate your activities, the important activities, which at the end of the day for evolutions are mating and feeding. Once you sorted those out, you might as well, idle or sleep the rest of the time. I think there is a very anthropomorphic vision of sleep when it comes to the science of it. We often tend to think, oh, if I just could give up sleep, I could be so much more productive. I could, paint, write books, and win races. And we all tend to see ourselves as a bit of Leonardo da Vinci, and with all this free time, what wonders could we make? But in fact, if this is a first very anthropomorphic point of view, not even that, I would say, because most probably humans, if they could just completely give up sleep, they'll still spend most of the time in front of the TV set anyway. but if you try to project this to animals, and you think, what would a cat do if they could completely give up sleep? Well, I cannot think of any productive, evolutionary productive activity that they're really giving up to in order to satisfy their sleep. So they probably just do enough for what they have to do. It's not like if they could stay 24 hours awake, they could mate much more or feed much more. That's what is done. So really, at the end, the species develop an equilibrium because between the sleep that they get and what else they have to do. It's just that humans do so many things that we tend to think that this equilibrium is unfair on us. But again, our lifestyle is very recent, the way we see it now. And if you see an anthropological studies, for instance, that were done in the early 1900s in those kind of tribes that lived a more primitive life than the rest of the world, what's been reported is that these people, not only do they sleep a lot, but they even have states which in these anthropological studies are labeled as idle, where these people, they just don't do anything, because, as I said, there is a limit to what an organism can do in their awake time.
That's really interesting, really fascinating. So the idea, one idea is that, just to make sure I understand this, if the species that maybe need more of their time spent for more important functions in the case of evolution, so feeding or mating, maybe sleep less, and those that can accomplish those very efficient likely sleep more because they're safer doing that.
Yeah, so this is something that we've seen, the field has seen, for instance, in herbivores, in mammals that are herbivores, that there is a huge correlation between the body size and the sleep amount. You see, if you are an elephant, you are big, and you rely only on leaves or whatever it is that they eat, then you must dedicate a lot of your time to finding food, to foraging. And so that is time that you cannot dedicate to sleep. Mm. But on the other hand, if you're a small animal, maybe carnivores, and you get all the calories in a quick meal, then you're done. So that's what a cat will do again. That's why they can sleep so long, especially house cats, where the food is served to them. They don't even have to go out and find it. We find, in fact, that those cats who actually are free to wander around, they have a huge elasticity on sleep amount. So, my cat in London, he will go the whole week on my bed just because the weather is bad outside. And then as soon as the weather improves, he might disappear for a few days and, come with a bird in his mouth or something. But, change dramatically his sleep amount based on his ecological needs. And clearly for these animals, sleep is, to a certain extent, a time filler for in many occasions.
Hmm. That's really interesting also that you bring up the idea of an individual being able to change the amount that they're sleeping relative to their internal drives or states. So, for example, you know, if they have an increased drive for, if they're hungry, if they've been starved.
Yeah.
Are you able to test these sorts of things in the lab?
Absolutely, yes. We see a bigger effect on internal states on sleep need. One is the one you just mentioned, the feeding state. You can starve an animal, and this will obviously change their hierarchy in terms of biological drive. If they've been starved, they know that they have to look for food, and so they dedicate less time to sleep. And so you starve the animals, they sleep less. On the other hand, you feed them, and they have a instinct for sleep. That's also what we have, what we call the postprandial, postprandial sleep, right? We live now in a society where we have access to food whenever we want. And so our sleep pattern is also linked to that fact, the fact that we are fed to satisfaction anytime we want. But this is not the norm for Homo sapiens. So there are other drives that can change sleep. The sleep need. We found in flies that sex is one of those. You can modulate not just the sleep amount, but also the response to sleep loss by modulating arousal, sexual arousal. So an animal that has been awake because they've been courting all night, they will not miss the sleep they've lost in this way. While an animal that has been awake because they've been fighting all night with another male, for instance, they will. And so they will have a huge sleep rebound and will try to recover the sleep they've lost. So how you stay awake also will impact on the type of sleep that you will try to recover the day after. And in humans, is to a certain extent, is also the same. Right? It's different to stay awake because you have to study for an exam all night, or to stay awake because you are with your lover and you enjoy your time. So it leaves a different burden on you.
So you mentioned about, you know, the drive to sleep if you've been awake all night, sleep homeostasis, right? So I'm really curious about that. We have sort of, as I understand it, these two drives that regulate the amount of sleep that we need, circadian rhythm-based drive and homeostatic drive. Now, as a neuroscientist, I feel like we've heard a lot about, you know, the mechanisms that regulate circadian rhythm. But homeostatic drive, at least to me, outside of this field, is not something that I've heard too much about. Do we really have a very good biological understanding of that drive?
Not at all, yes, you're right. I mean, clearly there is an imbalance between what we know about the circadian clock, which is a field mature enough to actually have won a Nobel Prize in 2017, and the other aspect of what is thought to be the control of sleep, which is the homeostatic drive. We don't know really what entails that drive, whether there are molecules or genes or neurons. I think part of it is because for a long time, sleep field was not somehow affected by the genetic revolution, the genomic revolution. So we did work with rodents, with humans, and those are animal models on which we did relatively little genetic manipulations. Orexin and narcolepsy are a bit of an exception, and in fact there you can see that we know more because of that. Clearly genetics has shaped our understanding of biomedicine in general, and the sleep field has not been interested by this revolution as much as the other fields. But now things are changing, also thanks to the studies we can do in fruit flies, but also in zebrafish. We probably unravel more genes working 20 years in fruit flies that regulates sleep than, you know, in 100 years in rodents, for obvious reasons. And again, there is a reason why the circadian rhythm is a solved field. It's because actually it was born the other way around. It was born from the genetics of the fruit flies in that case, actually, and then shown that the genetics that regulates the circadian clock in the fruit flies is the same in mammals. But we started with the genetics. We started with that work. And so that really clearly show more successful and productive. Now the challenge is trying to understand whether there is a regulation of homeostatic, where it is. Is it conserved from species to species? Because that also is not a given. And what is it for? Any homeostatic regulation has to exist just for its own sake. To a certain extent, I explain what I mean. Going back to the initial example of a bat sleeping 20 hours and an elephant sleeping 2 hours, does the bat really need all those 20 hours of sleep for some mysterious function? if you just think in terms of homeostasis, you think, yes, they do, because if you sleep deprive them, they'll try to recover some of the sleep they've lost. They feel tired. But the question is, if there was an homeostatic control, then the bat will not sleep 22 hours to start with, because they will not feel tired after having less sleep, right? So a homeostatic control is the one system that maintains a certain level to fixed, whatever that is, and whatever is useful or not. We see we have evidence of homeostatic controls which are not necessarily geared toward the optimal level. For instance, when people who are obese and their calorie intake is much higher compared to what they normally would, so it's far from being physiological, but it's fixed. If I try to lose some weight and I give up a croissant or a glass of beer or something, then my body is trying to tell me by the homeostatic control, look, you really need that croissant. If you don't need that croissant, you'll die immediately. Go for it. That's not necessarily true, but that's how the homeostatic control works.
Hmm. That's really interesting. Hadn't thought about it like that before. I mean, why why would we have a system like that that's not necessarily advantageous to us but has such a strong, powerful drive over?
Because let's say nature wants you to stay out of trouble during the afternoon and avoid the scorching sun, you must have some punishment system embedded in your biology if you don't. And so if you don't obey that biological drive and you go out in the sun, your species will suffer because you might die, and your genes will not go on. And so the nature must make sure that there is some system that avoid you from counteracting that order.
I see. So it seems like what I'm getting is that there are several different functions of sleep. And I think you've put this together really nicely in sort of this three-part model of sleep. Maybe you could explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, so the three-part model of sleep is something that puts together definitions which are not new. The people have tried to put them forward over the past decades. But I think now I'm trying to put them together under one umbrella. And so I'm saying that it's not just one function of sleep. There are some functions of sleep which might be vital. So they might actually have to do really with some basic cell biological process. And again, if you think of calories when it comes to food, there might be some sleep calorie equivalent. We don't know what they are. Some people claim it's, membrane repair or DNA repair. We have no idea what it is. The big question there is that whatever it is something that must happen during sleep. And so it's always very difficult to think of something that must happen in the cell during sleep. But let's say there is something like this. We call it vital. And then on top of that, you have other functions which are useful. And those are, well-documented again, having to do with learning and memory, say with immune response, with wound healing, all kind of biological processes, and those might be species specific. So what is important, what is useful for a human might not be useful for a bat or for a fruit fly or for a snake. So you might have other functions which might differ from species to species. And finally, there is, in my opinion, the biggest chunk of sleep that we get is accessory, and that's the time filler, which then come on top. In principle, it seems like come on tops of the other two, but in fact, the other way around. So sleep evolved as a time filler, evolved to make sure that flies don't go out in the afternoon and animals that rely on the visual system don't go out in the night. That's how it evolved and it was born. And then on top of that, it might have acquired species-specific function that piggyback throughout evolution to satisfy, some particular biological process, and maybe some vital functions that might be so important that we cannot get without. But we have no really, we have no really strong evidence of that, and for sure we don't have any good candidate at the moment. But I think even putting these things in the proper order and perspective can help us finding those if they do exist. So if we start acknowledging that sleep has evolved as a time filler, and then on top of that, other functions might have accumulated, then at least we can explain paradoxes like bats sleeping 20 hours and elephants sleeping 2 hours. At least now with this model in mind, we can explain it. Or if we can explain how a migratory bird can go in one season sleeping normally, 10 hours a day, And then during migratory season, they just can go for weeks or months without hardly any sleep. Now, again, with this model, we can explain it because we can say the accessory sleep actually acts as a buffer and it creates most of your sleep need, but at the same time, it can be adapted ecologically to remove those.
Really fascinating and really comprehensive and somewhat counterintuitive, as you brought up, like when we, you know, just casually think about sleep. So it's really satisfying to hear.
I think one aspect is we all experience, obviously, sleep, and we all have a very strong subjective opinion on what sleep is for us. And we all know that, sleep is, lack of sleep is detrimental, or at least it makes us so, unfunctioning sometimes. But at the same time, as I said, we have to come to terms that homeostasis is a necessary process if you want to maintain a certain level. And that feeling that we have, the feeling of being tired, might not necessarily reflect the fact that we're lacking sleep, but rather the fact that we've been punished because we are not reaching the species-specific set amount of sleep that we need. And so that creates this confusion. But if we start thinking of this in terms of evolution, then it becomes clear how this is really the only way to explain all the differences, and actually I think it makes sense.
So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about some other really interesting work that you brought up in your seminar this morning, which is sensory processing during sleep. Maybe you could just explain to our listeners a little bit about the question that you were looking at and the approach that you took.
Yeah, so this is a study that we published in 2021 about sensory processing during sleep in fruit flies. And to me, this is actually a study that has more to do with consciousness than with sleep, to be honest. Mm. The question is, while we sleep, we're still able to perceive stimuli around us. And humans, for instance, can respond to the name, to the sound of their own name being called and wake up to it. We can respond to different noises and words, and we can recognize ton of words. We can also learn those. For instance, parents of newborns, they understand somehow instinctively that they have to wake up whenever the baby is making the tiniest noise. I think this is a common experience. You might suddenly wake up to just a small call of the baby. This is interesting, though, because it means that during sleep, a time where you are not fully conscious, still part of your brain retain this consciousness and are able to not just receive the stimuli, but also make sense of them and decide whether they're a certain word is meaningful or not, meaningful enough to wake up. And so there is little research in animals done on this, some early research done in humans in the 60s. And so we thought this is a perfect, actually, ground for Drosophila to kick in. And so we did these experiments where we give flies different odors of different valence. And we found that, indeed, flies respond to some odors, which are important to them, but not to others. And the valence of these odors, so the importance that the relative importance that these odors have, can change depending on the internal state of the animal, for instance. So if you slightly starve the fly, they will not respond. They will keep sleeping if you challenge them with odors that have nothing to do with food, but they will actually wake up more easily if you give them odors that remind them of food. And so we show this from the behavioral point of view. So we show that flies have this property, but then, and that's the beauty of flies at this very moment, we can then go on and look at the neuronal circuits underlying this. And using optogenetics, thermogenetics, and all this kind of circuit analysis, you can now start turning neurons on and off and see what neurons interferes with this process, what makes it easier, what makes it more difficult. And you can pinpoint all the way from the nose to the sleep center how the signal goes and where the gate mechanisms are, and how the brain will, in some conditions, open a gate and make a stimulus more meaningful, or close a gate and make it less meaningful.
So depending on internal state, it might affect the activity of certain neural circuit that would then...
Yeah, it's a typical example of, really, I would say, a systems neuroscience, where you start with a behavior and then you look at the circuit and then you manipulate the circuit. So those three things together, behavior, circuit, and circuit function or manipulation, I think is what really creates system neuroscience. And I think in these flies are really, really good. We can do stuff that we could not do with other animals. Definitely, this was, I guess, the case. You know, this one paper is a good evidence. On the other hand, that's probably why it was done for the first time, because we could do it in flies. Why would not been able to do this in other animal models? And it's also, you know, a good reminder that we share so much with them. Even these properties that, in a way, we think of as consciousness properties, we share it with them. So in a way, I think it's not too long till we start asking consciousness questions using fruit fly as a model.
That's great. Interesting. I'm excited to see us defining consciousness in fruit flies. Why sleep? How did you get interested in doing sleep? You were trained, I think, as a more of a developmental biologist, in Drosophila, I believe.
Yes.
You worked. And then during your postdoc started investigating the question of sleep. What was it that really...
I joined the field because I was attracted from the neural development. And this was early 2000, and development was still, you know, a very hot field. And Drosophila was a good model to study that. But then something happens at the beginning of the year 2000s, and somehow the whole of neuroscience, but just the whole of biology, really kind of they grew out of love a little bit with development, I think, for no really specific reason, because I think this love will come back. I mean, the one thing that's always, I mean, not always, but often been said, is that a lot of the developmental processes were solved and there was not much to work on. I think this is absolutely not true. We will go back to it in no time. But clearly there was a behavior and circuit neuroscience and system neuroscience in general started becoming more interesting. So just really kind of career point of view, I was looking into how can I establish hopefully my future lab. At that point, I had to decide where to do a postdoc, and I thought sleep was a great field to do that, because it was still unexplored, still is to a certain extent, and that was the right time for flies to join the field. I could somehow foresee all these tools coming up, probably because I was lucky enough to have done a PhD in a lab, Barry Dixon's in Vienna, where a lot of stuff was being created in the first place. So I had some kind of insider view, let's say. It was a bit of an epiphany when I started approaching this problem, because, and I see this epiphany now in many people when I tell them that I work on sleep and we don't know what the function of sleep is. They immediately seem taken aback. They don't realize that we don't know what the function of sleep is. And it's a bit crazy if you think about it, because we think, you know, we dedicate so much time of our lives to it. But again, I think a lot of this comes from the fact that we see sleep as a time that is stolen from our productive activities. So again, that was basically the process. Then when I had this epiphany, I myself fell in love with the topic and decided to study, to start working on it. And then at the beginning of my lab, I decided that the tools that we had were not really the best. And so I invested a lot of time working on creating new tools, as we said. And I think that was the right thing to do. I wish more people did that. Unfortunately, the current academic system puts a lot of pressure on people exactly at the beginning of their independent career, right? They have this tenure clock, particularly in the US, but in the UK, fortunately, we don't have that much. But the tenure clock somehow acts as a non-incentive to actually do the important stuff, and rather as an incentive to just simply publish things. So it's actually... the wrong thing. It's counterproductive. And in my case, I decided to ignore that, and we invested several years working on this technology, which then has made us silent for a while, but eventually, yeah, it was the right thing to do. And I think it's necessary. One necessity in science is to create new technology and share them and use them.
Right. So what's next in the lab? Do you have anything exciting that you might want to share with us? Some new result you're excited about?
Well, I mean, we're working on this evolution of sleep in other Drosophila species. We also continuing the work on the sensory processing, trying to see whether, for instance, whether flies can be told that a certain odor has a valence. So you can do experiments where you give them an odor and that odor will not have no effect on their arousability. but now you can actually do a memory and learning experiment where you previously thought them to that disorder actually has a valence for some kind. It could be negative or positive. And then the question is, will they react to it? And if they do, then it's interesting because you can go down to the brain again and look at what has changed in the circuit, what kind of, you know, synaptic connections are new or have been lost. So in general, I think what has changed, what is driving me is this tripartitic model. Try to see, you know, what kind of hypotheses can generate and how can we those test and falsify those. And so this is what is driving me at the moment. And eventually it will be good to then extend this model beyond flies, obviously.
Right. Well, we can't wait to see what's going to come out from your work in the next 10 years or so. And it's been really a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for watching today.
If you like this video podcast, make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more cool neuroscience.